Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Bruce Cairns, faculty chair and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, about Burns' courage and leadership. A remarkable man. I'm looking forward to talking with him.
You know, we've had his brother on the show before, and I think this is a fascinating family and leadership.
We should have their parents. Like, how did you do this?
maybe there's other brothers that maybe be adopted into the family. But first off, Christy, we've got some important research that matters that we want to talk to our listeners about, including a statement in the journal Stroke about neck manipulation and possible stroke.
And we'll talk about expanding waistlines or being overweight can cause up to 3,500 more cancers each year.
About the high-dose flu vaccine, and if you're an elderly over the age of 65, should you be getting that over the standard flu vaccination?
And major variations in blood tests, but as little as a swing from $7 to $10,000 for the same test. Hard to believe. Let's jump right in with neck manipulation. Have you ever had your neck cracked, Adam?
Well, there's a little difference between having it cracked and having it manipulated, I think,
Tell me a little bit.
Though I can't say it is different fully. But yes, I have had neck manipulation done by a chiropractor in my circumstance, along with back manipulation when I had some back pain and I thought that it might hasten my resolution.
Well, you know, my husband had that done by a trainer, manipulated the neck when he was a Division I athlete. And ever since, I mean, he remembers that moment, and ever since we attribute his neck problems back to that moment. It may not be true, but it's not been a good thing, at least for his life. Well, but a lot of people love it.
And I know chiropractic manipulation is well established for the treatment of low back pain. And there is a difference between having what's called passive motion and range of motion versus active manipulation, particularly high velocity manipulation.
Now, I have a sudden big jerk.
Yeah, so I have arthritis in my neck, and I just really am worried about having a high velocity change in my neck.
Somebody holds your head and jerks it real quick?
Yeah, and just worried that that just didn't necessarily feel right to me. And I guess the question really is, though, is that potentially dangerous? Because we do other things in medicine that you and I do that have side effects and risk, like giving someone an injection in their knee and possibly have an infection of the joint. We know that everything we do has risk and benefits.
Exactly. And so this was a study that was, or a statement actually, published in the American Heart Association's journal Stroke, appropriately named because it's about elements in our research that are related to strokes. And this was looking at an association between a cervical dissection in the neck, which is a type of tear of the artery that can lead to a stroke, with having manipulation or something forceful happen to your neck over time.
This sudden movement that extends or rotates the neck, and even certain like rapid sports movements where you're rotating the neck really, really quickly, these things have been associated in this particular statement with potentially leading to this carotid artery, that artery that goes up the neck, a dissection where it kind of begins to split apart, and that can be associated with strokes. And this isn't a causal association, but I think it is a cause for warning. And I think that if one is undergoing any procedure in medicine, just like we talked about with the knees, you should know the benefits and the risk. And clearly the risk could be a carotid artery dissection. It needs to be explained to people so they can make an informed decision.
Well, and also I think if you were having symptoms of a stroke, or if you were in the hospital, or if something was happening that was not explained to you, you might mention to your doctor if you'd had this done recently, because it might be associated. It might not, but it might be. So the jury's still out, but it needs further discussion and research, as almost everything does.
Well, this next research that matters, I'm not sure if we need a whole lot more research.
No.
Because this one, the jury may not be out.
Good point. This is about obesity
and cancer. And what's the association between extra weight and many common cancers. I found this interesting, shocking, even though I kind of knew it.
I know. Well, we've talked about this on the show several times, various cancers being related to obesity. But this was a study published in the Lancet Medical Journal, good journal, and it was looking at data from 5 million adults in England, so in the United Kingdom, and looking at 10 different cancers that were associated with excess weight.
Yeah, you know, and the cancers of the uterus, where the excess weight was responsible for almost over 40% of cases, but also in cancers of the gallbladder, kidney, liver, and colon, where it caused 10% or more. This is impressive because this is potentially avoidable, preventable cancers.
And then they found that with each little jump of increase in your body mass index, or the BMI that you often hear your doctor talk about, that as there was an increase in BMI, it was also linked with a higher risk of cancers of those different 10 cancers.
Right. For every 12, I think about every 12 pounds increase, there was a much higher risk. I mean, with cancer of the uterus, 62% increase for that 12 pound increase.
Yeah. I think it was, you know, based on those 5 points of BMI. But as you gain, it made your risk higher. So the question is, for one thing, losing weight has many benefits for you. But this doesn't necessarily prove that losing weight will reduce that risk. But I think common sense says that it probably does.
And it's one of the kind of cost-effective, cost-efficient
sure.
and good things to improve your overall health. And we don't really think about cancer risk as part of that. So thinking about other ways of improving your health, Christy, our next research is a study of high-dose flu vaccine. Had you heard of this?
Yeah. Well, before this had come out, I mean, before this year, this was not something that was on the radar of different doses. This is a 4 times the dose of a flu vaccine called the Fluzone high-dose vaccine that was studied in the elderly and found that it is more effective. So it gives you about... For a regular flu vaccine, gives you about 60% effectiveness to prevent you from getting the flu shot. But when you get this higher dose to the elderly, it increases it by 15 or 20% from. So, you know, still doesn't make it perfect, but increases the chance that it'll prevent the flu for the elderly.
Right. The Centers for Disease Control and the Advisory Committee on Immunizations haven't yet recommended this for people over age 65 compared to the standard dose. But I think it's reasonable to begin to ask about it and to ask your doctor about this. Certainly, if you're one of these people who really doesn't like the flu vaccination, you think it causes a lot of problems, you're probably not going to be a big fan of the high dose one. But on the other hand, if you say, goodness gracious, I want to make my chances of getting it much less, this may be something that's right for you, and it's certainly reasonable to ask your physician.
Sure. If you've already gotten your vaccine this year, then I would just put this on the discussion for next year, but something to look for.
Yeah, speaking of something to look for, our last research that matters, Christy, is about the cost of blood testing. And this was research that was published in the journal BMJ, or British Medical Journal, Open, and coming out of California, where they looked at the variation in the cost of common laboratory tests like cholesterol medicines and basic chemistry profiles and found substantial variation.
So according to this finding, a cholesterol panel, so something not urgent, could cost patients anywhere from $10 to $10,000, depending on which hospital it was. And even within hospitals, it might vary across the hospital for different tests.
And it had Christy and I begin to wonder, do we really know, do our colleagues really know, the cost of all the common tests that we order? And I would say the answer is not as well as we should. And certainly from a patient perspective, I think it's very difficult. And so I think increasingly it's reasonable to ask, what is the cost of this test? And to pick tests instead of a whole metabolic profile, perhaps, to
just
pick the ones that you need, or to find out maybe it's cheaper to get the whole profile than getting 2 or 3 individual tests, becoming a lot more informed as consumers.
Yes, and there should be more transparency about this kind of thing for consumers as you go forward. So if you're getting a lab test that's not emergent or mandatory, you should ask and have access to how much it costs before you get that test done so you can make that informed decision.
Because increasingly, some of those costs will be passed on to patients. The health premiums will go up, and and the deductibles will go up. And so this is all something we're all interested in. Well, Christy, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We've had a chance to talk about blood tests and being aware of cost.
About neck manipulation might be associated with stroke.
And certainly at least having those warnings in before you have it done. About the high-dose flu vaccination and whether you want to ask your doctor about it.
And about obesity and a link to multiple different types of cancer. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Bruce Cairns, faculty chair and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burns Center, about burns, courage, and leadership. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Cairns, faculty chair and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burns Center, about burns, courage, and leadership.
Welcome, Dr. Cairns. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we'd love to start out with people's stories. And in particular, we'd love to know how you, as a young physician or medical student, became passionate about burns as your area of leadership and focus in your career.
Well, my history goes way back in Chapel Hill because I grew up in this town and I remember buying jelly from the JCs when they were raising money to start the Burn Center.
Wow.
And I had no idea that this would then come back into my life later on. I left Chapel Hill for college and medical school, but I did my residency at UNC. And one of the first rotations that I was on was the Burn Center. And I remember being struck. This was a surgery residency. I remember being struck with how challenging this situation is, but how proud I was to be a part of this center. I was very interested in the care of these patients, both adults and children, as well as the scientific questions related to wound care and infection control and so forth. And so I did a couple of years in a research laboratory. And then when I completed my surgery residency in 96, I was in the Navy and I went to Guam and took care of people from a 747 airplane crash who had combined burn trauma injury. And so I felt like I was being called to go back into burns and came back in 1999 and did my fellowship in trauma critical care at UNC. And then I've been on the faculty since 2000. I started off doing surgery, trauma, general surgery, critical care, burns, and starting a laboratory. That was a little bit much. And when I started getting grant funding for the research, I really focused on burn patients. And since then, we've rapidly grown over the years. We've probably expanded the volume 2.5 times over the past decade. So we had about 1,400 admissions in 2013, and we're probably the second busiest burn center in the nation.
Oh, really?
Well, you've just wrapped up a lot of really important, juicy things that we want to ask about a little bit more. And starting with, tell us about the JCs. We're the J.C. Burns Center. It's like almost like it slides off the tongue. There wasn't a Dr. J.C., I don't expect, like other things named in medicine. Tell us how this came to be. And is this the way burn centers around the United States are affiliated?
It's very unique. It's one of the things that makes us so different and I think so successful. JC stands for Junior Commerce, but they weren't the ones who originated the idea. The one who did it was John Stackhouse. He is an electrical contractor in Goldsboro, and he found that many of his employees were getting hurt, and there was no place for them to go for care. And so he studied burn centers across the nation. It's a relatively new discipline. And he went to all of the major academic centers in North Carolina and said, we really need to start a burn center. He met some resistance, but what he really decided to do was galvanize the people, and he chose the JCs as his major partner, but it also included the power concerns. So at that time, Carolina Power and Light, Duke Energy, the electrical co-ops, as well as the firefighters, and a number of other citizens across the state. So this is truly the People's Burn Center. We have an advisory board that meets every quarter, and we talk about raising funds, but mostly what we talk about is what do the patients need? What do their families need? What do our nurses and our therapists need? How can we be the best burn center in the nation? And for example, we have the largest aftercare program for a burn patient. Once you've been burned, you're a burn survivor for life. We have the oldest pediatric burn survivor camp in the nation. Our focus is really about patient-oriented care, long before others were talking about that, as well as team-oriented care. And so those are some of the aspects that are different. But why is it so different? Because it was driven by the people, starting with John Stackhouse.
Well, nice, what a remarkable story of what a passionate person with an important mission can do for the people of North Carolina and apparently nationally. For people who haven't had experience with a burn center or who aren't physicians, I think our listeners may not be fully aware of what the importance of a burn center is and what it's so different about burns that make them unique to other types of trauma.
It is very uniquely different. And the scars that you live with after you've been burned can really cause problems, both psychological and physical, for your lifetime. And how they're handled when it first occurs can really make a difference. And so it's not just the physicians and the nurses. They're very important, particularly our nurses. But it's also the therapists, occupational therapy and physical therapy in particular, that really is uniquely different. Because as you heal from a burn, the scars can really cause serious contractures. And so we have a comprehensive team that addresses the patient once they come in and develops a treatment plan and then works together as that treatment plan evolves. That also includes, by the way, the family, because that's such an important part of the patient's recovery. We also have social workers and pastoral care. There are a number of other issues that the patients and their families face, and this includes psychology and psychiatry, nutrition, pharmacy. I'm sure many of the issues that you all have talked about on your program and what we would like to see for the comprehensive care of people when they're ill, we really try to focus on that, not just while they're in the hospital, but once they're discharged and, in some cases, for the rest of their life.
So tell us about some of the common things that you're actually seeing there, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's difficult. This is hard work, but you have successes. What are some of the common things you're seeing, and why are you seeing them?
The most common injury is from the kitchen.
It's like
usually
what?
Grease fires.
How's that work?
So what happens is someone will have they'll be cooking something on the stove and they'll walk away and they'll come back and the pan will be on fire. And people just react. And if they step back, and we have educational messages, prevention messages that talk about what you should do. When you have a fire, what you must do is turn off the heat and cut off the oxygen. And so if you have a grease pan fire, turn off the burner and then find a lid or a cover and place it on top of that and then walk away. But what a lot of times happens is people will pick the pan up and then the grease will splatter their hand. It's very hot. They'll have a reaction and the pan spills and then they are burned that way. We have a lot of industrial injury in North Carolina. That's a whole nother issue that we have to deal with. Scald injuries from microwaves, both for the very young and the very old. We still have motor vehicle crashes where there's injuries in that. With that mechanism, we still have people who light fires with gasoline, which explodes rather than burns. We still see fireworks injuries, and that's a real problem for us, and bonfire injuries. And unfortunately, we also have a substantial population of pediatric burn abuse. We're the major referral center for that particular injury. But we have a wonderful, as you know, comprehensive child abuse team.
So I know one of the things that I was really happy a number of years ago to be able to work together with the work that I have done in research in tobacco prevention and cessation, was to work with your community educator and the leadership that you all did to help get a law passed in North Carolina to make the cigarettes sold be relatively fire resistant. So when they drop, they don't immediately ignite. But cigarette-associated burns at that time were one of the major causes of preventable and serious fatalities. Have we seen a change in being able to educate or being able to do things about those types of burns.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for that. That was such a huge success story for us. And it really demonstrates how advocacy and understanding how injuries occur and how this interfaces with the way we make products can really make a difference in society. And of course, I have to thank Ernest Grant, our prevention coordinator. But we work together to figure out how to solve this problem. And so it has fundamentally changed the way people think about cigarettes. We don't have that as much of a problem anymore. And as you recall, correctly, it was a real challenge, particularly in nursing homes. And so that's not what we see anymore. And so we talk about fire and burn prevention with the three E's. The fire service talk about the three E's: education, engineering, and enforcement. And so one of the other issues that's high on our list now is home sprinklers. There are a lot of myths about residential sprinklers, but if you look in every business, we have business sprinklers, but residential sprinklers would save lives and property. I see that in a similar way. And we have another saying in the burn center that we would love to be put out of business. We have other things that we could do. The injury is so tragic that if we could prevent these injuries, that would be our major focus.
Well, that's certainly an important step. And I know we have to take a break, but when we come back, I hope that we can talk a little bit about the courage that it takes for a physician, a nurse, an occupational therapist on the team to care for what must be some shocking and very horrifying patients and scenarios that you encounter, and the leadership that it takes to do that. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Bruce Cairns, faculty chair and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, about burns, courage, and leadership. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Bruce Cairns, faculty chair and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, about burns, courage, and leadership. And before the break, Dr. Cairns, you were sharing with us the growth of the Burn Center and the patient-centered focus and team approach, as well as some information about preventing burns. But I hoped we could move towards the courage that it takes to do that work in a patient-centered way, but also to support each other on the team. What does it take to remain passionate and focused on the patients, but also able to cope with what must be some shocking things that you see?
It's a great question, Kristen, and I've been asked that many times, and my answer has changed often over the years. And I don't really have a good answer for you. I would say, though, that when we took the Hippocratic Oath, our commitment was to do whatever it takes to help people. And this is what they need. And the response we get from the patients and their families is just remarkable. To go to the aftercare events, the children and the adults, to be there when no one else would, to not judge when others seem to judge. It really reminds you or reiterates what the human spirit is all about. It's just absolutely invigorating. And so we don't describe our patients as victims, but rather as burn survivors. Mm-hmm. But at one of our aftercare programs, one of our patients who really had a very challenging length of stay, almost a year long, she said, "I'm not a burn victim, I'm a burn victor." And so there's a lot of ownership that the patients take. And I would say that the courage is really coming from the patients. Mm-hmm. It comes from the families. It comes from the people who built the burn center. We're just stewards of that mission. And I think it's very similar to the mission we have at UNC as a public academic medical center. We are there to serve the people. That burn center is there to do what it takes to support our citizens. As long as we remember that, then we'll take care of ourselves. Not everyone can do it, but, you know, I can't do your job, Christy or Adam, because it requires a variety of different types of people to take care of all of the things that we have to do, but we share that common bond in that mission. And in fact, all of the disciplines at UNC work together. So we have people from cardiology, nephrology, and we do have people from family practice, medicine, psychiatry, all of the dermatology. We work very closely with them, the pediatric ICU. Everybody works together to support the patients in the burn center.
You know, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Cairns, the director of the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, but also chair of the faculty at University of North Carolina. And we were talking, you're talking about serving the people, and certainly serving the faculty of a large public institution. You've just come into this role, and it does take leadership and vision. How do you determine what the people that work at the University of North Carolina really want, and what do you think are the current challenges in that type of position that you perhaps have learned from your role as a doctor to help solve?
Well, another great question, Adam. I think the key is service. That I'm there as faculty chair to serve the faculty. We have 27 committees, 12 of them are elected, 15 are appointed. We start there, and it covers all of the issues related to appointments, promotion, tenure, faculty athletics, research, buildings, grounds, community, diversity. That's our starting point. And then we have the contemporary issues, particularly as they relate to the budget. I think that that's been our biggest challenge. The university has sustained over $300 million in budget cuts, and we focus a lot on the budget cuts, but we have to remember that the investment the citizens of the state are making in the university is still quite substantial. I believe it's about 20% of our total budget. And so we have to strike a balance between what we do and how we do it and how we make sure that we still have the best and brightest faculty. So that's one issue. We have had an enormous growth in fixed-term faculty, and they provide an enormous value and service to the university, but that's different than in some ways, the situation in the tenure track.
Fixed-term faculty meaning someone who's appointed for a year.
That's right, or 3 years. Mm-hmm. But in my view, they provide exactly the same service and value that our tenure track faculty have. They have a little bit of a different role, perhaps, but everybody's part of this university community, and so we have to figure out how to work on that. I think diversity is a big issue for us as well. We have a diverse population in our state. We have diverse missions as an institution. We have diverse schools. We have something like 17 schools and multiple centers and institutes. We have to make sure that the faculty represent the people of the state. And, of course, we know that's true in medicine as well. And we have a new administration, and we're working with them to help address the issues that they're trying to face as well. And of course, we have to continue to pursue research and service. And most importantly, the most important goal of the faculty is to support the students.
So you are already a major leader in your field as a physician in the area of burns, the director of this impressive burn center, one of the leaders in the nation. And then you decided to also become a major leader of the university. How, from your own personal journey, how did you make that leap, or what was it for you that made you decide to do both of those areas of leadership? And
one paid and one unpaid.
Yeah. I mean, that requires a lot of you personally to do all of those things in service. And for the young people out there looking at you thinking, wow, you know, how's that journey been for you?
Well, first of all, I'm just honored to be able to be in the position and humbled by it as well. We're just here to serve, do the best we can. There's still only 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year.
Do you sleep?
You can't do everything. And one of the missions of the Burn Center was to develop faculty as well. So I have three wonderful colleagues. I'm very proud of the diversity of the Burn Center. 75% of the faculty are people of color. 50% are African Americans, and we are very proud of the work they're doing. But they are the best there is in the business, and so they've been allowed to take over and do the work. And then we want to develop the next generation, the fellows and the residents and the students, and so that's just the natural evolution of getting old, and that But it's really part of the mentorship is a key aspect of these kinds of roles, so that you have the opportunity to then take on these other duties. But I think that when it came to the chair of the faculty, that's an election. I have to confess, I was asked to do this. This was not something I was out looking to do. But these are important times for the university, as you all know. And I think it's important. One of the wisest people I know said that if you are going to serve, you don't always have to step forward, but you can't step back when you're needed. And I think that's what we have to think about when we take on these roles.
So in our last minute, perhaps we can just return to where perhaps you have started from, which is taking care of people. And what you've described is this journey, taking care of people in service. When we think about our listeners across the country and internationally, what are the tips that you would give about preventing burns and about taking on and serving people? What are your top three tips?
I think be thoughtful and realize that your life can change in an instant. And so if in the back of your mind what you're getting ready to do doesn't seem like a good idea, think about that.
I mean, like putting your hand in a socket and you don't really know if the light fixture is on or off.
Or lighting that firecracker, or throwing gasoline on that fire, or seeing that gas pan, the fire in the kitchen.
Thank you for your service. Thanks for taking time to talk with us a little bit about that. We want to be sure to link people to information about the J.C. Burns Center. Is there a particular website, or should we just link it through UNC onto the blog?
I would link it through the UNC website.
Great. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Bruce Carnes, faculty chair of University of North Carolina and director of the North Carolina J.C. Burns Center, about Burns' courage and leadership. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam, we get to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
If any of our listeners have a question or concern they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, Christy, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our guest executive producer today, Caitlin Liu, to read us our very first House Call question. Caitlin?
I have a 14-year-old daughter who has always been independent, confident, and has excelled in whatever she puts her mind to. But I'm worried about her. Her appetite is suppressed, she is no longer physically active, and she has lost about 8 pounds. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, if you're worried, we're worried too. And I bet she would be open to talking about what's going on. But, you know, sometimes that's tricky with parents and daughters. But things that come to mind
are like depression, like
anxiety,
abuse, like anxiety, like
eating disorder, or like body image issues. Sometimes particularly if a child is very motivated and is able to achieve her goals, then if she wants to lose weight, that could be something that she's going for. But if she's sort of sitting around not doing as much as she was doing before, that really sounds a lot like depression.
Yeah, we don't like to jump to conclusions about diagnoses, but, you know, a description of someone who's independent, confident, and has excelled, that's someone who normally operates under tremendously high pressure and believes that, you know, in success. And that's what we want for all our children. But all our children are subjective to the same sorts of things that we are, which can be depression and uncertainty and body image
And bullying at school. Yeah. I mean, there could be a lot of different things going on here. So I would encourage you, as I'm sure, Adam, you would agree, to start that dialogue with your daughter, to have the conversation and to bring her into a health professional to talk about what's going on, maybe to get some a good history and a physical exam to make sure there's nothing else that comes out, and somebody who's experienced with depression and anxiety and some of these issues that might help you tease it out.
And sometimes it may be easy to say, you know, I'd like you to get a physical. I want you to get a checkup. I'm really concerned about you. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure there's nothing physically going on, and let's open a door. And we can sometimes be the fall guy and girl to do that physical. And maybe with you out of the room, we can bring up some concerns. You can contact your doctor, share your concerns, and then make an appointment.
Good advice. Let's take our next house call call.
My father is a patient at UNC Family Medicine. I currently live about 2.5 hours away at the coast, but thanks to your new patient portal, I am able to view my dad's test results without waiting for one of my siblings to send them months afterwards. I just wanted to let you know how thankful I am and to tell others how helpful this resource has been for me and my family.
Well, we appreciate that note, and we had on not too long ago Dr. Don Spencer, the head of IT for the University of North Carolina, talking about those new electronic health records and the one that University of North Carolina has called Epic, but many large institutions have across the country that allow this type of communication.
It is really tricky to care for a patient, to care for a parent, especially if you live far away. And so just hearing that this is helpful for you and thereby helpful to your father is part of the whole team approach that we really need that to be a family affair with, you know, partnered with the doctor. So this sounds like it's really helping you, and it's helping a lot of my patients. I don't know about you, Adam.
It is helping, but there are also some tricky things here.
Oh,
One of the tricky things here is the doctor being able to communicate with people other than the patient here. And whereas we hope and expect that you got permission from your parent to have this type of communication, it sometimes is a little tricky on our end. You might be able to get those lab results, but if you have questions about them and you want to talk with us about them, we may or may not actually be able to have that conversation with you.
Unless your father explains that to the doctor and gives the doctor full permission to do that sort of thing, then we can. So that's something to make sure that you've done also, is to be sure that the doctor knows who in the family, and it needs to come from your father, that who is the point of contact and who is it okay to share things with.
We like more information. We like transparency. And this does both. Thank you so much for that great question. Caitlin, what's our very next question, house call?
My husband travels all the time overseas, and I have never previously worried. Since the outbreak of diseases in the last year, specifically Ebola, I constantly worry. He travels to London mostly, and since this is the universal hub, I fear he will sit next to the wrong person and contract something. How should people protect themselves and their families when traveling overseas?
Oh, you're worried. And Ebola is scary. There's no doubt about that, just because there's not a cure for it. And for some people get very, very sick and don't survive it. At the same time, we have an international world where people are traveling, and it sounds like that's something that he has to do potentially for his job. It's not clear in the question, but sounds like it. And so there's sort of this balance of likelihood of picking up something like that and what we have to do to continue to carry on with our lives.
Yeah. One of the things about Ebola virus, which Christy and I have committed to actually doing a show on Ebola.
Yes.
And bringing as much new information out there, because it's very confusing, and there's several different types of viruses that are classified as Ebola viruses. But they are viruses. And in this particular case, the good news is it doesn't appear it's transmitted typically by the coughing or the sneezing. It's a person-to-person contact with the body fluids. And so certainly you would not want to be sitting necessarily next to someone in that element. And anyone who's sitting there coughing and sneezing and spreading potential contagious on next to you on a plane or in an airport terminal, I would try to remove myself from that, or to ensure that they have a face mask on, because there are a lot more common things that you may be exposed to than Ebola virus, like tuberculosis and other elements. These are still rare, and the exposures, but I think keeping a healthy awareness is a good thing.
So I would just encourage him to wash his hands, to avoid people who look really sick, and then keep, you know, in contact about the latest information about Ebola and the countries that he needs to travel to. And then there's some element of letting go of some of these risks that are still rare for people in our country, and thankfully so, and trying to carry on.
Well, Christy, I think that'll conclude what we have time for on House Calls today. But we really want to thank all of our listeners for sharing important questions and concerns with us.
And we want to have you email your questions, share your stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook. Get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the UNC North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Bruce Cairns, and our guest producer today, Caitlin Liu. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.